This is Car Expert.
Above the headliner, there are a multitude of magnets, so entire car is a subwoofer.
They probably could have sold it for 50 grand, made 10 grand more profit per unit, and they'd still have sold out.
I find it hard to see a world in which a Jeep Wrangler with a giant V8 under the bonnet is anything but absolutely terrifying and hilarious.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. This week I'm joined by Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
And Scott Colley, hello.
Hello, hello.
Last week in Car News, we touched on a little bit about this with EV levies in some states in Australia. But, Moko, we've had a bit of an update with ACT this week.
Yeah, so just to remind our listeners, South Australia and now New South Wales have proposed introducing a road tax or road levy, mileage levy, whatever you want to call it, on EVs, because EV drivers, of course, don't pay a fuel excise. The silly thing to that, of course, is that EV drivers pay more tax because their cars are more expensive and there's GST and stamp duty attached to them, not to mention luxury car tax. But what's interesting to me is in the absence of an overarching federal policy, the ACT has gone in the polar opposite direction and has decided to directly incentivise EVs rather than disincentivise EVs like South Australia and New South Wales. Scully, you wrote the story and I was really interested in it. What just catch us up. What is the ACT actually proposing?
So essentially, where a lot of other states have sort of said, we want electric vehicles to just fight it out on the market and we'll sell as many as we sell, the ACT has decided it wants all of its new car sales to be zero emissions by 2030. It's not talking about a ban, which is something that's being discussed in some parts of Europe and certain US states, I believe, as well. But instead, it wants to really incentivize people to buy electric vehicles by allowing interest-free loans of up to $15,000 for people to invest in zero emissions technologies, and along with electric cars, that's things like solar panels and home batteries. It's also going to offer 2 years of free registration for electric vehicle buyers under the plan, and that's going to happen as soon as they can practically implement it, so very soon. And they're going to build 50 electric charging stations around Canberra and the surrounding regions to try and offset some of the range anxiety, because obviously Canberra is a town where a lot of people live for work. And so there are people who do commute in and out of Canberra. And if you can, you know, make people in the region comfortable driving an electric vehicle from their, you know, their town 100 or 150 or 200 Ks away, then you're going to go a long way to encouraging adoption as well. I think the other interesting thing is Canberra and the surrounding areas are also going to focus on electric vehicles for public transport. So buses are going to be made zero emissions, and they're going to convert two of the big bus depots in Canberra into charging stations for new electric buses, because as we know, commercial vehicles like buses, provided they're on a short route, are actually really perfect for electric conversion, because we know exactly how far they travel each day. They're generally parked at night, and because they're on a fleet, if one battery is flat, there's generally another bus that can sub in. So along with encouraging fleets and people to buy electric, the government has also taken sort of some sort of leadership and said, well, we can do this ourselves with our fleet of public transport buses, and we're going to invest in that too.
What's really interesting to me is, and I sort of touched on it before, but we're really seeing now, you know, the federal government, for its ideological reasons, has said, we're going to let the market sort itself out. We're not going to interject, like we've seen, say, Boris Johnson in the UK come out and say, you know, from 2030 onwards, no non-hybrid or EVs will be even allowed. But in this sort of breach that's been created, for good or for bad, you're seeing the states deciding to enact their own policies. And I'm really interested to see how we're going to unify those, because at some point Australia is going to have a unified policy around electric and hydrogen. Right now, we've got states going in quite opposite directions to each other. And the longer you leave it, the harder it's going to get to unify. So while you'd love to see, in my opinion, ACT's model kind of replicated, it'd be really genuinely interesting to see what the feds decide to do.
I find it really difficult to understand the policy of South Australia and New South Wales in trying to tax what is such a young technology. I don't disagree with the idea that's been put forward by a couple of states and also some car makers. Kia in particular, its boss Damien Meredith has mentioned taxing electric vehicles as a key to making them roll out around Australia. But we're at such a stage here where there's such a small percentage of vehicles on the road, and we know the benefits of them can be so great when they're rolled out correctly. I find it really hard to understand how other states in 12 months' time or 24 months' time could be looking at the ACT and the number of electric vehicles on the road there and going, oh, no, we're still going to go the South Australia route. I think it's going to become very clear very quickly what the more sensible path is. And for now, at least, until these vehicles are a big enough part of our roads to justify taxing them and looking to replace the fuel excise, I just don't understand how you could pick the South Australian direction.
If you've got any thoughts about this, please let us know. We'd love to hear your feedback, podcast@carexpert.com.au. And we'll get stuck into the rest of this week's car news now. Over to you first, Scully. 2021 Toyota GR Yaris is sold out.
Yeah, there's a game we play, the news team, sometimes, where if we're not quite sure about a story, we will put the headline in the simplest terms possible. So, for example, if a car in the US is updated that we don't get in Australia, it's overseas car updated, Australia not impacted, and we go, well, that's not really a story worth running. And on those terms, popular car sells out, probably not that interesting, but the fact that the GR Yaris was launched with such a sharp drive-away price and Toyota actually expected its stock to last for 12 months, the fact it sold out in, I want to say, 6 to 8 weeks, essentially, and it could be late next year before Toyota can get more cars, if it can actually manage to at all in Australia, is really, really significant. Earlier this week, online orders for the car closed, and Toyota's essentially said there will be some stock left at dealerships because either people will cancel their orders, their financial situation changes, or dealer demos might be put up for sale. But if you want to buy a GR Yaris, you now can't get one fresh yourself. You're going to have to pick up someone else's order or get a car that's already been specced by a dealer. And yeah, Toyota's said that it's working with head office to get more supply late next year, but there's no guarantee of that at the moment. So realistically, and maybe this doesn't sound surprising to us, but I think the way Toyota spoke about this car at launch was, we're not quite sure how sales are going to go. We're going to really push it quite aggressively, and this should last us a year. I think the fact that Australia is still really passionate about punchy, homologated hot hatches has come as a little bit of a surprise, but is a really welcome surprise, and hopefully it encourages some more of the really cool performance cars and niche stuff from overseas that we don't get at the moment to eventually come to Australia.
So I can hear in the distance the screaming of Toyota management, including Sean Hanley, their head of product, because they decided to sell this car for $40,000 drive away, which is an incredibly discounted rate, as we've spoken about. So they basically took the money that they would normally spend on marketing the car and took that off the price of each unit and sold it at an absolute bargain basement to create this army of enthusiasts. But in actual fact, they probably could have sold it for $50,000, made $10,000 more profit per unit, and they'd still have sold out because the popularity has been that great. There's been tons of people that missed out. So, you know, kudos to Toyota for doing what it did and making this car so incredibly affordable for what is essentially one of the world's most potent pocket rockets. But man, what an opportunity gone. They could have made so much more money off it.
It's also going to be really interesting to see, now that Toyota's sold the base GR at $40,000 and then $45,000 drive away, where they price the Rally, which is essentially the circuit pack that's offered overseas. You get locking differentials, forged BBS alloy wheels and a race suspension and very sticky Michelin Pilot Sport 4S tyres. Given the list price recommended for the normal GR Yaris was $49,500 before on-road costs, I think it's reasonable to assume, based on the equipment you get, that it's at least $5,000 or $10,000 more for the Rally. I do wonder if the enthusiasm we've seen for 1,100 GR Yarises will also translate to the 250 Rallies, given they're likely to be a little bit more expensive, or whether the fact that this is such a bargain is what's driven it. Because for me, it's really, yeah, there's a really interesting balance between like turbo three-cylinder engine, 200 kilowatts, Rally all-wheel drive system. So exciting. But I think also the fact it's such a bargain has been a really, really big part of why it's being talked about so much. And I wonder if that'll translate to the Rally, which on paper is a more capable car again, but could be quite pricey for what is such a small car.
I tell you what, the likes of Volkswagen with the Polo GDI, Ford with the Fiesta ST, Hyundai with the Imman and i20N, will be breathing a sigh of relief, I think, right now, because that's, you know, a little bit less competition for their pocket rockets, because as good as those cars are, none of them even come close to the GI Yaris when it comes to output or dynamic capabilities on paper. So, yeah, they're lucky people who got their hands on one of these. I hope there's another shipment at some point next year or the year after, but wow. And what a great endorsement of Aussie car enthusiasts that they're still willing to buy a manual all-wheel drive expensive hot hatch, you know, cheap for what it is, but still ultimately a pretty expensive hot hatch. Doesn't it say a lot about the car culture in Australia that vehicles like that can still actually find so many homes? You know, you've got these weird little niche cars that Australians just gravitate to. So as much as we talk about Aussies becoming boring and only caring about soccer mum SUVs and macho work utes, there is still a niche of car buyers that absolutely adore weird, wacky, wonderful vehicles, and it really makes my heart sing.
Based on what I've seen on, I've joined a GR Yaris forum on Facebook, and it does seem like everyone on there, I mean, if they care enough to be on the forum, they're obviously not going to flip their car, but there is a real passion and excitement from people who've bought these cars to actually get them. So from what I've seen, and again, it's a limited sample size, but I do think that there is a real passion for it, and hopefully, based on that, they're the people who are going to be, you know, driving their cars every day, smashing them on the track and hanging on to them rather than just treating it as an investment.
Absolutely. We'll move on to another fun little car. The 2021 Subaru BRZ has been revealed and it's coming to Australia, Moko.
Yeah, so it's the second gen of what really became, well, obviously the Toyota 86 / Subaru BRZ joint venture really became iconic cars, didn't they? You know, I remember the when they first arrived, it was sort of low $30,000 mark, sub 30K in the case of Toyota, just over 30 in the case of Subaru, rear-wheel drive, manual gearbox, aspirated engine, insanely fun to drive, kind of a beginner's track car. And this new one, happily in my eyes, and Scott, you're a former BRZ owner, so I'm sure you agree, happily in my eyes, retains what made the previous one such a magic experience. So this new BRZ is clearly more of an evolution than a revolution. It uses a version of the old platform, though it's stiffer and a little bit longer than before and a little bit lower as well in the body. It has a naturally aspirated engine still, so no turbo, and those people who complain about the lack of a turbo will still be miffed, but it's now a 2.4-litre four-cylinder, of course, in flat boxer guise, with 170 kilowatts of power, at least that's the claim, and 249 newton-metres of torque. So that's up from 152 kilowatts and 212 newton-metres in the old car. Still three pedals and a six-speed manual gearbox with a short throw, although there is, of course, a six-speed torque converter auto to choose from as well. And really, the company looks like it's fettled a lot of the suspension and kinematics dynamics without fundamentally changing what the car offers. So it promises to remain a simple, basic throwback product that absolutely loves power oversteering. I'm wrapped in the fact that it doesn't get a turbo because that means that you have to rev the car, you have to drive the car angrily. And of course, a slow car driven in anger is far more fun than a ridiculously fast car going at 2/10. So I love the philosophy that Subaru has retained here. It looks very similar to the outgoing model, especially in terms of the window line and the side profile, though it has a much more aggressive nose, really big intakes and airflow sections just behind the front wheels that give it quite a muscular character from the side, distinctive body lines, much more muscular flared rear haunches and a different tail light and boot design to sort of make it stand out from the outgoing car. So it looks a sort of familiar but a little bit different and fresher. Big changes inside, much better infotainment, similar kind of touch points, similar rotary dials and controls, but it all looks a treat. The seats look super grippy. I'm really a fan of this. I think, you know, reading between the lines, Toyota and Subaru weren't going to invest vast sums of money in what is still a fairly niche product. So it was always going to be about just keeping it fresh and updating it. And it appears on paper that they've done exactly that. I'm looking forward to seeing Toyota's take, the 86, because, of course, they're doing a derivation of this car. But, yeah, and in terms of Australia, Subaru hasn't given us an exact date, but I've been told pretty reliably that it'll be the end of next year. So, you know, at some point in 2021, hopefully we can get our hands on one. Scully, as a former committed devotee of the BRZ, what do you think when you saw this?
I was really excited, and I didn't know what to expect when, because there have been all sorts of rumors about it getting a turbo, wouldn't get a turbo, be TNGA, wouldn't be TNGA. I think that there's still going to be things about it that annoyed me about my car. There are things in the interior that I can already see that haven't changed that I would have liked to see change. But realistically, it's almost as if Subaru has just taken a list of the things that I would have complained about in my car and fixed them. I mean, the infotainment now looks much better, which when you're on the track doesn't matter. But of course, you don't live at the track. You drive these cars every day. So it needs to be good for most of the stuff you do. From what I've read in the US, peak torque comes on tap at about 3,700 revs, which is just before in my car, it just fell in a gigantic black hole. It was like someone attached a weight to the rev counter. It also looks a little bit tougher and it's got, you know, a really neat digital instrument dial, but without fundamentally changing the formula. So, yeah, I just think Subaru has nailed it on paper. I'm really, really excited with what we've seen so far and I can't wait to drive it because it just sounds like they've taken what was a really good formula for, you know, novice track drivers and young people who want a sports car but can't afford to buy or insure or maintain something big and expensive and turbocharged. It just seems perfect to me.
Scully, to give you a little plug as well, I sub-edited a opinion piece that you have written on the BRZ from the perspective of a former owner talking about the new one, particularly espousing your happiness that the company hasn't gone down the road of turbocharging or overcomplication or overt cost increases. So if you're listening to this now, go to the site and check out Scott's opinion column on the BRZ and let us know what you think of that too.
Yeah, that'll be live on Saturday morning. So it will have gone live just before the podcast goes live. And to give a little bit of a spoiler, I'm very glad that Toyota and Subaru have stayed the course and not sort of been sucked into the game of trying to make their car all things to all people, because the best cars or the most entertaining cars are the ones that really have a singular goal or focus in mind and they really drill into that. And this new BRZ seems to have the same focus as the old one on paper at least. So, yeah, very exciting.
Sounds like a very pure car. All right, moving on. The 2021 Jeep Wrangler Rubicon, the 392, has officially been revealed. But, Scully, this one's not coming to Australia.
It's not. So we love a V8 and we love an off-roader. And unfortunately, this V8 off-roader is not coming to us. At the moment, it's going to be left-hand drive only, which is often the case with this really cool stuff coming out of the States. There's going to be plenty of demand over there. And we're such a small market, it's tough to justify sending it here. But our fingers are crossed that in a couple of years' time, once all of the off-road yobos in the US have bought them, there's a little bit more production capacity and it can be sent to Australia. The Rubicon 392 it's a really cool car on paper and it does seem like a pretty strong response to the Ford Bronco, which goes head-to-head with the Wrangler and has a turbocharged EcoBoost V6 engine that made the Wrangler's naturally aspirated V6 look a little bit underpowered. And if there's one thing you can't try and do to Fiat Chrysler at the moment, which is just putting a V8 into everything, it's make it look underpowered. So it's slotted a 6.4-litre V8 into the Wrangler with 350 kilowatts of power and 637 newton metres, which is good for a 0 to 60 mile an hour or 97 kilometre an hour time of just 4.5 seconds and a 13-second quarter mile. I have no idea what that would feel like in a regular Wrangler, which is already a little bit breezy, let alone a Wrangler with all of the doors and the roof and the windows taken off. I'm very curious to try that. I think it would feel like you're doing a million miles an hour.
Yeah. This is what I was going to flag was, you know, it's obviously a body on frame, live axled, hardcore off-roader with panels that come off. I'm wondering what the body rigidity is going to be like in this thing. Even the Grand Cherokee Trackhawk with its ridiculous V8 engine is a real handful. Like, it's an absolute laugh and a half. Especially if you're not particularly worried about climate change. But, you know, it's not the last word in dynamism either, because it's obviously an off-roader. And this Wrangler just takes that to the next level. So I suspect this car will be equal parts hilarious and kind of terrifying at the same time, which, you know, it's certainly going to have a heck of a lot of character. And, you know, knowing the American market and how massively popular that Bronco has been, I think this will be a sellout success for a little while.
So has done some stuff to make it not bend in half the first time you step on the throttle, which is good news, obviously. There's a stronger ladder frame. There's new suspension parts, bigger brakes as well, which is good because stopping is more important than going, I would argue, in a car with a 2-star, 3-star crash rating. It's got a two inch, so 5 centimeter lift kit. I'm not sure about making the center of gravity higher on a car with a big V8 nose, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's a whole lot of bits and pieces under the nose to cool the V8 that need to actually be housed higher off the ground to keep this trail rating. I think really interesting is the fact that Jeep has actually developed a clever air intake for this. It's a three-layer system, and even when water comes up over the bonnet and in through the bonnet scoop, it's able to filter the water out so the engine can still breathe and not flood itself. Apparently, the car can also deliver peak performance if that functional air intake is covered by snow or by mud or something like that. So it does seem like some real thought has gone into making the V8 still work off-road and making the car, you know, ready to handle it. But, yeah, I find it hard to see a world in which a Jeep Wrangler with a giant V8 under the bonnet is anything but absolutely terrifying and hilarious.
Have you ever been sand driving? I've been lucky enough to do quite a bit of sand dune driving, and that is where this car will absolutely shine, because you need to stay absolutely on it and you need a hell of a lot of power and torque to sort of motor through that really soft sand that you get on dunes. And I think people who love duning in particular, and there's lots of those in Oz, but there's also lots of those in America, are going to go absolutely nuts for this car.
And lastly, the 2022 Honda Civic sedan has been ruled out, which is really disappointing, Moko, because I think this is a far better looking car than the hatch.
Yeah, so the bad news is, well, I'll go back to the start. So Honda revealed the 11th generation Civic. Just to show you how far times have changed, it revealed it on Twitch, which is a pretty bold new approach, in alleged prototype form, though I'm staggered that it's been called a prototype because it looks 100% production ready, no concept car accoutrements whatsoever. It's the sedan version, which is currently sold in Australia in 10th generation guys, and it looks beautiful to this very day. The new one will not be sold in Australia, but the good news is the hatch version and the Type R version of said hatch will both come to Australia, so there will be a Civic moving forward. But just to get back to this sedan, which is principally focused on the US, you're right, it looks great. It's a little bit more conventional than the current sedan, which is very, very sporty. This one's a little bit more practical looking, but it's got a really nice clean design. A lot of those fussy detail elements that the outgoing Civic has, this car doesn't have. Its proportions are spot on. There's quite a lot of inspiration taken from the new Accord, which is no bad thing. And then you go into the interior and it's quite a simple stripped-back affair, a sort of floating screen, really nice looking wheel, very minimalist. It's definitely borrowed a little bit from that beautiful Honda E electric hatchback, not in terms of the screens running the full width of the car, but in terms of some of the touch points and dials and things. It looks $1 million. I certainly hope the hatch will retain all the other commonalities, and based on some renders and also some pattern images that we've seen, the hatch should look very similar to the sedan, so a sort of similar vibe. And of course, the fact that the Type R has been confirmed for Australia yet again is also something that will fill driving enthusiasts with joy. Obviously one of the more popular nameplates on the market, and good to see that the company's sticking with it.
I'm looking forward to seeing how much bigger they can go with that spoiler on the Type R.
It does seem like it's going to be a good base for the Type R, because the Type R is still the best driving hot hatch of pretty much any of them. Mocha, I remember you and I a couple of years ago having an absolute blast in the Type R. It's just a brilliant car to drive. But on top of all the fake vents that are already on the normal Civic, they then added more fake vents and more wings and spoilers, and it's all just a bit much. So the idea of a kind of touring car style Type R, where it's a normal, fairly simple, clean design that's just got all the right bits put on top of that, I think it's going to look really, really sharp.
Head to carexpert.com.au, check out the photos of the Civic, and let us know in the comments or email podcast@carexpert.com.au. Hello again, William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy, how's it going?
Very well, thank you. As we know, you're a bit of a Genesis man. You've spoken about your G80 that you own before on the podcast. And the reason why we've got you on the podcast this week, you've just driven the recent Genesis G80, no doubt a massive difference between the one you own and this current model.
Yes, so I own a 2015 Hyundai Genesis Ultimate, which was eventually rebadged here as a Genesis G80. So I went to the launch of the second generation Genesis G80. And look, it is quite a change from the outgoing model, I can say that. This is the very interesting thing about Genesis. Once, and I say this in my review as well, once you actually know what a Genesis is, and a lot of people still don't, you'll instantly recognize this as a Genesis from the split headlight and taillight design on the outside to the really curvaceous lines to that very controversial steering wheel design. This is, Genesis calls this like the most pure expression of their design language yet. And it is very distinctively a Genesis, but it is definitely a luxury car inside. You've just got bloody acres of open pore wood trim, which is gorgeous. You've got everything is soft touch. If it's not soft touch plastic, it's wrapped in leather. Then you've got a luxury package which changes that leather to Napa leather. So it is definitely a class act inside and out.
Will, the previous Genesis G80 we got in Australia only ever had the V6 engine, but in America there was a big V8 that always looked really cool. Is there a V8 option in this one, and do we get the full engine range?
There is not, but we almost do. So we missed out on quite a few things with the last G80. We missed out on the V8, as you mentioned. We also missed out on the twin turbocharged 3.3-litre V6, so they introduced a G80 Sport. We got a Sport design, which looked like a Sport, but we missed out on that twin turbo, which would have been lovely. Certainly would have been bloody thirsty, because I know that I don't get great fuel economy in my naturally aspirated 3.8-litre G80. But look, we actually do get the two petrol engines that are available in most markets. So you've got a turbocharged 2.5-litre four-cylinder engine is the base engine, and then you've got a twin-turbo 3.5-litre V6 as the up-spec engine. Now, if you want rear-wheel drive, you've got to get the four-cylinder. If you want all-wheel drive, you've got to get the V6. Other markets will allow you to get an all-wheel drive 4 or a rear-wheel drive V6. No. That's just not going on here. We also miss out on the diesel. I'm not terribly upset about that because it is not the lovely 3-liter inline six turbo diesel that's in the GV80. It's actually a 2.2-liter turbo diesel 4, which, I'm sure it drives all right, but I don't think that's a great loss. But to answer your question, we're not missing out on anything really juicy. And it's actually really good Genesis has committed to a vehicle in what is ultimately quite a shrinking segment. We've already seen models like the Lexus GS and the Volvo S90 just disappear from our market. The Jaguar XF has been pared down to a single variant. So for Genesis to actually commit to two different powertrains is really nice. That means it's just a very, very simple two-model range. However, Genesis has said that they are going to bring over anything that is basically everything's going to be engineered for right-hand drive, effectively. So they'll bring over whatever they can get their hands on. So that bodes well for the electric G80 that we've seen spy photos of. So battery electric, no internal combustion engine there. That also bodes well for what I imagine would be the inevitable Sport variant, which I would be very excited to get my hands on.
Well, in terms of spec, I'm having a look here and it's got pretty much everything you could possibly want. It's got a 14.5-inch touchscreen, sat-nav with augmented reality, a 12-inch head-up display, a 21-speaker Harman Kardon Lexicon premium sound system, adjustable ambient lighting, an ELSD, LED matrix headlights further up the range. I mean, it looks like it's lacking absolutely nothing. Do you think that the value equation stacks up? Obviously, being a startup luxury brand without the equity of the Germans, it has to make up for that with, you know, incredible value for money, I guess. Does it tick that box in your mind?
Well, one, thank you for listing those items because that saves me some breath because it is a very long standard equipment list. And if you're not happy with that level of spec, there's actually just one option package. That's it. You've got two options. You've got matte paint or you've got the $13,000 luxury package. But that package adds just about anything that you can think of. Remote smart parking assist. It makes the rear seats heated, ventilated, and power reclining. It adds a rear seat entertainment system, which you actually can't even get on the GV80. Soft closed doors, you know, all of that lovely stuff. The only thing I would say about that option package that I'm a little bit disapproving of is that reverse parking collision avoidance assist. If you want that, you've got to shell out for the option package. That's a bit weird. But in terms of spec, look, this just absolutely wipes the floor with a 520i or an E200. It also undercuts them on price. Now, that comes with a caveat. Genesis has a fixed pricing model. you're not going to be able to negotiate thousands off like the Germans will do. And that being said, Mercedes is switching to a fixed pricing model soon anyway. But right off the bat, yes, it is cheaper. It is better equipped than a base Model E or a base Model 5, but you're not going to be able to take any more off of that price. So I'd say overall, yeah, it does still stack up as really good value. Genesis is working on a guaranteed future value program as well, if you're concerned about resale value, which, I mean, it is a new brand that a lot of people haven't heard of, so I can understand why that would be something that people would be concerned about. But this is extremely well equipped.
So, Will, two-part question for you. I suppose part one is, how does it drive? And part two is, does it feel identifiably like a Genesis based on your experience with your car? Because I think that's one of the things that if you hop into a BMW 5 Series, although the car has progressed a long way over a long period of time, there are still parts of the drive that are identifiably BMW instantly.
Yeah, look, I think I'm going to be able to give you paint a better picture for you in a few weeks, because I'm going to be able to get my hands on a G80 2.5T very soon up here in Brisbane. So with launch drives, I mean, as you know, you've been doing this a long time. It's quite a limited drive. But I did notice, even in that limited drive of, you know, one day, I did notice a few differences between this and the outgoing model. Now, there's another caveat here in that the car that I own, that I've owned since earlier this year, was rebranded as a Genesis G80 after a few years. But that model actually added adaptive suspension. That was pretty much like really the only change. So I've not actually driven that model with adaptive suspension. But the new G80 has got adaptive suspension in a 3.5T and just a passive setup in the 2.5T. And both of those models have a very different feel from each other and also from my car. My car, this might actually surprise you if you haven't driven one before, because you think it might be some, you know, plush, floaty Korean Luxo barge like a Kia K900 or something like that. But it can actually hustle. I've taken it numerous times up to Mount Glorious and Mount Nebo, and the handling at the limit is actually really good. The flip side to that is it rides on 19-inch wheels and it has a surprisingly firm ride at times. The 3.8 litre V6 sounds great, but, you know, it's got a torque deficit compared to the new G80s. So I can see some improvements there in terms of the ride quality in the new model has definitely improved. It's definitely a lot plusher. The flip side to that is I don't think, based on my experience, that the handling is quite as good at the limit. It definitely feels a little bit softer than the old car. However, look, let's be real. Most people who drive a G80 don't drive a G80 like the way I drive a G80. So, as you know, as Al was going to test, I had to drive him down the road the other day, and as soon as he sat in the car, he reached for the grab handle. I'm like, we haven't even left our street yet. I'm a safe driver, but you know, I'm a spirited driver. But for most people who are buying a G80, buying a plush, you know, very highly specified large luxury sedan, I think this probably strikes a better balance. I think that the 2.5 was probably my pick because the body control, yeah, there's something about the 3.5T, you definitely feel the weight a little bit more. There's a little bit of understeer when you go into corners. And it doesn't feel massively quicker because these cars aren't tuned for that, like, race off the line, you know, traffic light Grand Prix style of driving. They're all about very effortless, smooth power. So in that respect, the 3.5T didn't actually feel massively quicker, even though it is quite a bit more powerful. So I think I prefer the 2.5T. I think, though, what would be really great to drive would potentially be the 3.5T with rear-wheel drive, but unfortunately we don't get that here.
So, Will, you kind of touched on one of the questions I had before, which was the fact that there's fixed pricing. But the other side of the equation is that Genesis is really going, you know, it's not bothering to put its cars in Hyundai dealers. Just like Lexus, it's having its own network. But they're not conventional dealers. They're sort of, you know, dedicated brand centres, for lack of a better word. And as far as I know, there's only one or two of them at the moment. And they're planning to roll it out, you know, a little bit greater over the years to come, but it's still a very small footprint. So if you're going to go and look at a Genesis or buy a Genesis, do you think they're making it too difficult to actually achieve that at the moment? Or are you convinced by the plans that the brand has for its network moving forward?
That's something that they do love to tout. There is their Genesis to You program, where if you're not able to go into any of their studios, of which there's currently only one open in Sydney, two test drive centres in the greater Sydney area, and one opening in Melbourne very soon, and another one planned for Brisbane. So still, it's even after that, it's not going to be a huge network by any means. But this Genesis to You program means that if you live within 60, I want to say, kilometres of a major urban centre, you can say, hey, look, hey, Genesis, I really want to check out this G80, but I can't get to one of your studios because I live in most places in Australia. So can you please bring one to me? And they will actually bring one along for you to drive. So I think that's a really good program. And they've also got a very good after-sales package as well, in terms of, you know, free servicing for the first few years, and roadside assistance and all of that included. So, look, I think that they would do well to have a larger network, but I also disagree with the idea that, which a lot of people do put forward, they're like, well, you know, they would sell more if they just sold them in Hyundai showrooms. Yes, but that's not the point. I don't think that's how you establish a luxury brand. That's certainly not how Lexus was established. You didn't go and pick up your LS400 next to Starlet. It's going to take time. I think anybody who's expecting Genesis to just instantly be a challenger overnight needs a little bit of a reality check. But I also don't think that they're going to be the next Infiniti, because we're talking about a brand that has got a very you know, comprehensive after sales package. But we're also looking at a brand that has come here with the best and the brightest. They've come here with an entirely fresh range of vehicles, and they're finally, you know, they're actually bringing out SUVs, which is probably the most important thing. I don't foresee this G80 to be a big seller. I think Genesis expects it to sell about as well as the last car. And that's also interesting, because they're targeting more private buyers this time, and they're also targeting younger buyers with the G80. But I don't think this is going to just take the segment by storm, but I think it will probably sell about as steadily as the last one. And I think it deserves to in that respect.
Yeah, definitely. You can keep your eye on carexpert.com.au once that review is live. William Stopford, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mandy.
It's the week of luxurious sedans. The next one on the cards is a big step up from the Genesis G80. In fact, it's right up there, possibly being one of the most luxurious sedans you could ever buy, the Rolls-Royce Ghost. And which better man to talk about this car? None other than Tony Crawford. Hello, Tony.
Hello, guys. How are you? Let me just correct you. It is the holy grail of luxury motoring, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
What about the Phantom, mate?
Yes.
No. Look. Well, I'm talking Rolls Royce as a mark here. Like, it is the last word in luxury.
So what about Cullinan?
Rolls Royce again. as I keep saying, Rolls Royce is the benchmark, is the holy grail of luxury motoring. It always has been. When the first Silver Ghost was built in 1906. They acclaimed it, the world acclaimed it as the best car in the world, quote unquote. So
you were 25 when that happened, right? In 1906?
Wasn't that. But oddly enough, I do have a bit of a connection with this brand, because my father, who hired forklift trucks for a living, he actually bought one, a Silver Shadow, in 1979 from a Melbourne dealer mate of his, Richard Lane, I believe. The Lanes, and drove it home, and it was an olive green car, and I've never been more excited in my life. Literally almost rolled down the stairs trying to get down to the garage quick enough to see this thing. And then sort of a few years later, when Mum would take the car and drop us at school, we had to be dropped off the street before, because no one wanted to be seen in the roller. It's quite odd.
I was going to say, mate, next time I hear you talking about your, you know, hard upbringing, how you had to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, now I know that your dad had a Rolls Royce. I'm not convinced.
But he only paid 16 grand for it, Mocha.
adjusted from 1847 shillings. That's a lot now.
And he put the boys at the workshop onto it, so there were no maintenance charges.
What a ripper.
Oh, my God. Go. So can you describe the ghost in one word?
Oh, sublime. There's so much. This is the most technically advanced Rolls-Royce ever. And by some margin, I might add. Like just the superstructure is hand welded by four welders that have to weld the joints at the same time to minimize any torsional incorrectness, if you like. Like this is next level engineering. So the big thing of this car is the previous owners of the original Ghost, which was called the Goodwood Ghost, which came out in 2009, they came with like 200 sheets of recommendations and specifications that they felt was needed in an update or a new model, as this is. And the main crux of those recommendations was that they wanted a less ostentatious car. Now, that will sing in Moko's ears, a less ostentatious car. So that meant less shut lines. So they got rid of the shut line that used to exist just behind the Spirit of Ecstasy emblem, and that's gone. And the roof, the entire roof, and from where it drips down to the A-pillar, B-pillar, and C-pillar, right down to the rear tail light, that's all one piece. Just, you know, like it's one piece of metal. I mean, it's incredible the level of engineering that went into this car. And like the audio system is bespoke. So that could have gone out, I suppose, to Bang & Olufsen and said, you know, we want the Rolls-Royce version of Bang & Olufsen. No, they didn't do that. They got together a collection of three or four of the best audio files in the world and let them run amok and pick out the componentry they wanted to produce the world's finest audio system that suited the Rolls-Royce Ghost. And, I mean, even the roof, above the headliner, there are multitude of magnets. So, in actual fact, the entire car is a magnet or a subwoofer, if you like. Like, yeah, I mean, you just can't be overawed by this car enough. I mean, it's just astonishing. The roof liner below those magnets is called the Starlight Headliner. There are between 1,450 and 1,600 LEDs in that roof. I couldn't quite get anyone to knuckle down on an exact or a precise figure. No one seems to know, believe it or not.
So, Tony, I think the fact that they don't know is because each one's different, isn't it? Aren't they all laid out to be different constellations?
Not each one is different. There are obviously, you know, 1,600 LEDs, and within those LEDs, there are eight of them that are actually shooting stars, and that happens every 8 seconds. So on a lovely night going to a restaurant with the passengers in the back, they will see shooting stars go across the headliner as you would in a constellation. It's pretty amazing. Now, speaking of constellations, there's another starlight constellation effect on the front fascia in front of the front passenger. And that panel has the word ghost in it. And apparently there are seven layers of panels. To produce that effect, and there are 850 stars within that panel. Apparently, there are 90,000 dots behind that panel that make every star appear like a star from any angle, rather than just a glob of light. I mean, what do you say to engineer that? That apparently, by the way, took 10,000 hours to develop properly, that one component. Yeah, this is why you pay $628,000 plus on roads, plus options, the headliner being an option, the Starlight headliner being an option, for your car. And I guess some people think that's, you know, a bargain when you get that level of engineering and 10,000 hours for one little panel. I mean, that's just extraordinary in itself. Now, this car, You know, it weighs over 2.5 tons. I mean, this is a big, big car. It's 5.5 plus meters long, almost 2 meters wide. This is a huge car, but it's now got all-wheel steering, all-wheel drive. So you can drive this car around. We were driving this car around, you know, a year ago when I first got to drive, well, it's not exactly a roller, but I was driving a Bentley with rear wheel or all wheel steer, and that we were going around Monaco in that car. It was about the same length. So we were going around streets in Sydney, very tight turns and that, and yet it's like anyone could drive this car. Now, you might think a car like that is nice and stately, but under the bonnet is a 6.75 litre, which they've always had for some reason. They've always had a 6.75 litre. It used to be a V8. Now it's a twin-turbo V12. And it will do 0 to 100 in, believe it or not, 4.8 seconds. That's right, the big roller. You don't want to take it on at the traffic lights. It might dump you.
So, Tony, the Phantom has always been the big Rolls-Royce that's meant to be, you're meant to be driven in. And from what I understand, the Ghost was always the one that you were meant to drive yourself.
Yeah,
it was meant to be a little bit more of a personal car. So does this sort of still fit the bill as the younger person's driving Rolls-Royce?
100%. Yeah, I believe the average age of a Ghost customer is around 40, 45. But you know, most people, they say, will in fact drive their own Ghost, but some will sit back there, and some of the features, of course, there are suicide doors, so the doors open from the middle, both of them, and they open very wide, so you can just like walk straight in as though it was a bedroom or a house, and you sit there, and of course it's a bit far to sort of reach to close that rear passenger door, so you've got a button just above you that you just hold and it closes the door. The doors also open automatically just by holding the little button on the door handle and pulling it, and it sort of automatically comes with your hand. It's amazing. And engineering technology within the drive system. So it's got a world first in planar suspension. So it's a geometric term, planar, and in other words, straight. So this car rides flat. You don't feel bumps because this planar suspension actually has on the front dampers, which are, of course, adaptive, it has a damper to dampen the dampers because it wants to dampen away any vibration that might happen when it's actually damping. So, it requires a lot of explanation of how all this works, but essentially you don't feel bumps, and you've got two stereo cameras that look well above the, or well beyond the, the front of the car, and it sets up the damping. Now, that's not a first, but this particular having the damper on the dampers is. There are other cars that actually look ahead and prep the suspension system. The transmission is GPS driven, so it also plans the gear changes based on the road ahead and the topography of the tarmac.
Hey, Croft.
Yeah,
I'm just wondering. Obviously, with Rolls Royces, we're familiar with how incredibly detailed the leather and the wood trims and the lighting and all those fit and finish features, but the few times in my life where I've been in a Rolls Royce or driven a Rolls Royce, I've noticed that it doesn't have a particular focus on in-car tech in terms of infotainment or digitized instruments or active safety features, the sort of things that a top-of-the-range S-Class or Maybach absolutely nails. Does this new one use its BMW ownership better and come with some of the more contemporary tech that most buyers are looking for today, or does it still feel a bit old world?
No, it does get all the latest touchscreen, big screens, super clear, high res stuff. I'll preface this by saying I'm not sure about the safety stuff. We didn't really go into that at this launch. It was only a sort of a 2.5 hour drive, so we didn't get to dive, you know, that deep into it. But tech-wise, yeah, it's right up there. The instrument display is a beautiful, almost like 3D, but digitized binnacles. And that is a beautiful, that absolutely fantastic when you're sitting there looking at this thing, the numbers and the information that coming up on the screen, the head-up display is crystal with just the right information. So it is a bit, the whole thing, they want to be subtle. They don't want it to be in your face. So the dash itself is fairly minimalistic with open pore wood, all this sort of stuff, but all the tech is under there. Trust me, it is right up to date as far as technology goes. And I suspect, without knowing, that the safety features would be up there as well. But we'll have to come back to that when we actually review the car, which I'm going to do on the weekend. The actual door sill, the top of the door sill, you know, the rail that runs along a car at the front. Well, they basically sent four people around the world in order to find out, because it's almost not there, it's almost invisible. Those four people went around the world measuring raindrops in various continents and to make sure that the rail, because it's so minimalistic, would also be able to capture the raindrop and let it run down the rail of the car. I thought that was next level. That's, you know, who does that? I mean,
goodness gracious.
Yeah. I'm just blown away by the shut line behind the Spirit of Ecstasy, because I don't own a Ghost, obviously, but I just cannot tell you how many nights I've laid awake worrying about it. So I'm pleased they've fixed it.
They do. But it does look incredibly gracious now, and probably, that the Phantom is ostentatious, the Ghost is probably not, can sort of meld in, if you like, because it is very, very smooth. Those lines just flow.
Head to carexpert.com.au and search for the Rolls-Royce Ghost. Tony Crawford, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mandy.
And that brings an end to this week's podcast. What cars have we got in the garage over the next week, Moko?
Oh, we've got some rippers. Things have definitely lifted, especially down here in Melbourne, now that the COVID situation has chilled out just a little bit. I've been testing the new Gen 4 Escape up against the Toyota RAV4 top seller. I've also been running a test of the updated Hyundai i30 in N-Line Premium, guys, against a Mazda 3 G25 Astana hatchback. We've got a Ford Puma ST-Line V, which is the top specker of Ford's new compact SUV. We've got a bit of a throwback car, a Jeep Grand Cherokee with a 5.7-litre V8. We've got a Toyota Yaris Hybrid, the updated Alfa Romeo Giulia Sport, an Audi RS7 Sportback, which I'm delighted to say has my initials next to it. So all of you, get your hands off that car. That's mine. we've got the new Range Rover Evoque up in Sydney with Jacinda, and a couple of cars up in Brizzy, including the Lexus LC500 update, and the launch of the updated Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross. So we are positively drowning in new metal at the moment, and I am delighted to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, every story and review at Car Expert is worth reading, Scully, but are there any that we should highlight for this week?
Yeah, just read all of them, I guess. Thanks for coming. No, we've got some good opinion pieces going live over the weekend. I say that because I wrote one of them. I realize how immodest that sounds now I've said it out loud, out of habit.
Given I've subbed it and had a close read, and I can confirm it's a pretty good piece. So don't beat yourself up, mate.
There we go. Moko says it's a good piece. I'll take that. But Monday, as this podcast goes live, we've got the Mercedes-Benz GLA 250 review and a video from Paul going live. And then Tuesday next week, we've got the new Toyota Hilux SR5 cab chassis, which is a really interesting spec. And we got to do some cool stuff in and around the four-wheel drive proving ground in Werribee. We've also got in the pipeline a launch review of the Alfa Romeo Giulia Sport and then the BMW 4 Series as well, coming in the next couple of weeks. So there's all sorts of interesting stuff happening, and cars are starting to be launched again as the world opens up. And, yeah, I just think read everything is the best thing I can say.
We'd have a very short podcast if we just said that every week, wouldn't we?
Hello and welcome to the Car Expert Podcast. We're going to name three different Rolls-Royces. Read everything. Goodbye.
Scott Colley and Mike Costello, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mandy.